The views and opinions expressed by hosts, invited speakers, and callers do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of the Black Talk Media Project or the Black Talk Radio Network.
Sunday night. It is 11/29/2015. We are pretty much at the end of the month of November, taking it on out to the end of the year and bringing in 2016 with the bang. I know you already have your goals set, and I know you've been checking things off from this year, which you set out to accomplish at the beginning of this year. I know you've been checking them off. Good for you. We need to check up on everyone and just follow up and see where are you with your 2015 goals. Well, tonight, we thought of discussing Fred Hampton of Chicago, Illinois, Chairman Fred Hampton from Chicago, Illinois, who is stationed in Chicago, Illinois. Chairman Fred Hampton, I thought of him last week during an interview when the video of Laquan McDonald. And the video of Laquan McDonald was revealed. It was revealed in that video that he had been shot by the police officer 16 times as the young man walked away and was on the ground. Just a horrific death. But that's not an isolated death. It's not as horrific. It's not like the most horrific death. Oh my God, this just happened. We've never seen anything like this. Because I thought of Fred Hampton, who was also shot in his sleep. While he was in bed with his pregnant wife right there in the same city in Chicago. And so during that interview, I mentioned that this was nothing new. This is not an isolated event. We keep saying this. This is not new. This is not new. This has been going on for quite some time. I was reading also Ida B. Wells' autobiography. And in 1901, going into the 1900s, Ida B. Wells was organizing people in Chicago against these brutal interrogations and the wickedness of the Cook County Police Department. 1901, Ida B. Wells. Then here we go with Fred Hampton in 1969 being assassinated, somebody who organized food banks for people, political education in the community. A brother that was dedicated to the community, and his life was taken because of that. So his birthday is on December the 4th coming up. So I thought that it would be appropriate just to start the week out just saluting him. And maybe after listening to a few of his words, and I hope to play more of his documentary on YouTube. I believe it's called The Murder of Fred Hampton. So you can pull it up on YouTube. You know, I love YouTube, my documentaries. But we will also share clips of that video and others tonight, Wednesday, and as well as Friday, in honor of Chairman Fred Hampton, a revolutionary. That's one thing he said. You can kill a revolutionary, but you can't kill the revolution. And his spirit lives in so many people. His son, Fred Hampton Jr., speaks quite often about his father. He invokes his passion and his wisdom and words. And quite often people say, well, if we had another leader, we need some more leaders. I would say, if you want to be a leader, if you want to step out, if you're looking for a leader, look for these characteristics that existed in his brother, Chairman Fred Hampton. So let me just start off. I think first I want to play this Pan-African prayer by In the Tradition Band, and then we are going to go into some Fred Hampton, Chairman Fred Hampton, and also Ta-Nehisi Coates. I also thought of Ta-Nehisi Coates because I listened to, I just started reading his book, Between Me and the World. It's a book, started out as like a letter to his son, and it evolved into this book. He speaks of a story of his friend Prince, who was killed by police there in like the Baltimore area. And as he mentioned, this is nothing new. The cameras are what's new. We've seen this in our communities for years, but now we have the advent of cameras on the phone, thus leading to more people filming these police killings. So all of this time when people have been saying, oh, you're making this up, you're exaggerating, that doesn't happen. It doesn't happen to me. I've never seen it happen. Well, thank goodness we have people that are able to pull out those cell phones and now document some of this. So for those people that wanted to pretend like we were exaggerating, now we have it all on tape. Speaking of which, this week another hot topic that came out, the Burger King in the area where Laquan McDonald was executed by cops. The cops named that actually unloaded his gun and was about to reload until his co-workers told him to, you know, cool out, you killer. I believe his name is Van Dyke. I can't think of his first name, and I'm not really even trying to remember the man's first name because he's an idiot. He's crazy. He's a killer. He killed a child in the street. So anyway, it is said by a manager at the Burger King restaurant in that area, it was stated that the cops came in and erased several minutes of that tape. So they should not have even been able to allow to come in without a warrant to view that tape and then to steal minutes from that tape. That's a recording of a crime. So they needed a warrant for that anyway. So that's a whole another subject. Where are the black lawyers? Where are the black lawyers? I just don't know. But anyway, so let me play a little bit of this just to get us started and then get us in the mood. Let me get this Pan-African prayer up. All right, here we are.
current of oceans. Our torso is a triangle of Africans dispersed. We speak to the world across deserts, jungles, savannas, shorelines, creeks, mountains, rivers, cities, neighborhoods, barrios, and favelas. We speak across boundaries, invisible and visible. We speak across color lines, dividing for centuries. We speak into the great arms of heavens and earth, embracing ancestral spirits with our breath now. From past to present to time beyond time's time, we speak from old and young hearts to you, you who came through bellies of destruction, from captivity through slave caves, through the door of no return. Bodies as commodity, branded as inhuman. You who stand as an ascendant of Ma'afa, from Accra to Sangha Bereku, to Apam to Anomabo, to Cape Coast to Elvina, to Shama and Sekundi. Two sisters and brothers bound together with global memories, histories, realities of the living. Bodies branded with transatlantic slave ship ports and the arrogance of empire. Rio de Janeiro, Bahia, Liverpool, London, Nantes, Bristol, Pemabuco, Cartagena, Paramaribo, Recife, Brebes, Essequibo, Demerara. They said, the barbarians in Africa belong to us. Their huts, villages, and lands belong to us. Their knowledge of agriculture, their animals and farms belong to us. Their ancient libraries belong to us. They said their civilizations belong to us. Their art and music belong to us. Their gold and diamonds belong to us. Their ways of trade belong to us. Their ways of worship will be destroyed. Their ways of survival will be destroyed. Their ways of communicating will be destroyed. Brains, minds, mouths, tongues, teeth, hair, skin, muscles, bones, vaginas, penises, breasts belong to us. The profit from their bodies and labor belong to us. We will control them through serfdom, forced labor, debt bondage, chattel slavery, Jim Crow, racism, rape, segregation, whipping, beating, hanging, burning, maiming, blinding, chopping off feet, hands, and genitals when they run. Banks, insurance, trade, plantations, plantations, trade, insurance, banks, diamonds, gold, coal, oil, cotton, and textiles, sugarcane, coffee, cocoa, tobacco, rice, and plutonium. All of it belong to us. Here are prayer for African people, our prayer of connection, community, recognition, reclamation, reparations, knowledge, love, peace, beauty, intelligence, wisdom, justice, power, strength, foundation, sisters and brothers across Akibalon, Kemet, Nubia, Africa, Philippines, Vietnam, Korea, China, Laos, Cambodia, India, Japan, Europe, the U.S., Canada, Argentina, Barbados, Basra, Belize, Brazil, Chile, Costa Rica, Colombia, Cuba, Ecuador, El Salvador, Guatemala, Guyana, Haiti, Honduras, Jamaica, Mexico, Peru, Melanesia, New Zealand, Australia, Puerto Rico, Trinidad. Hear our prayer for African people that came out of Angola, Ghana, Mozambique, Madagascar, Nigeria, Senegal, Senegambia, Sierra Leone, and Windward Coast, Gorey Island, Freetown, Coromandel, and Dix Cove. Across this place known as these united, untied states of institutionalized confusion, from Alabama, Charleston, Georgia, Jamestown, Maryland, Massachusetts, Mississippi, New Orleans, New York, Richmond, and Rhode Island. My name was North Voyage. My name was South Voyage. My name is Wolof, Mandinka, Serer, Fula, Chemne, Mende, Kise, Bai, Day, Baza, Grebo, Batwa, Congo, Igbo, Yoruba. They call me slave, they call me Negrito, they call me Negro, they call me black. They call me Moro. They call me Moreno. They call me Mulatto Mestizo. They call me mixed. They call me autistic. They call me dumb nigga. They call me disabled. They call me black killer. My name is Negritude. My name is Negrismo. My name is Harlem Renaissance. My name is blues, jazz, rock and roll, rhythm and blues, Motown, hip hop. My name is Bosamayo, the place of memories. My name was Long Walk, eyes hidden in darkness. They say I am from the people of a time gone by, the ones that disappeared, people of the lost tribes of Shabazz, reappearing in this here and now. And now they call me failed urban city. They call me uneducated, dysfunctional, minority. They call me poor. They call me broken home. They call me at risk. They call me underclass. They call me no economic development in 50 years. They call me unemployed, disrespected scholar. They call me, let's forget, institutionalized racism and always act like it doesn't exist. While populations of black people are searching for jobs and fresh, healthy food, live out days devastated and displaced in Detroit, in Chicago, D.C., Los Angeles, and Oakland, Watson, San Francisco, Miami, Phoenix, Houston, Austin, New Orleans, Boston, Philadelphia, Cleveland, Toledo, Windsor, Toronto, Rio, and Cuba. This is a break.
And that is In the Tradition Band. And she certainly named my city and Delta. I believe she said Mississippi, the state of Mississippi. Chicago, for sure. We're honoring Chairman Fred. And in light of all that has been going on in Chicago, with the continuous killings, Delta, Farrakhan just had his Million Man March. Farrakhan and the Nation of Islam, headquartered in Chicago, Rakia Board, that awful killing, with so many others. And just time after time, we see all of these killings in Chicago. Spike Lee has his film, Chi-Rat, and I did get a chance to see a trailer, and it is nothing like I thought what the movie would represent, Delta. Have you been able to see a trailer of that Spike Lee movie?
No, I haven't.
I'm thinking I
just heard them
movie.
Talking about it. That's about it. I haven't heard
them. Probably can pull it up. Spike Lee Chi-Rat trailer. It'll come up on your little iPhone there. But you should check it out. It's nothing like I thought. I thought it would be more like documenting, maybe like Rakia Boyd's death, clips of the trial, different people who lost loved ones, all the children that's been shot in the park or something, and just like different maybe community organizations, what are they doing? Footage of Farrakhan speaking. You know, I thought it would be more like that. And maybe like a compare and contrast of, since people call Chicago Chi-Rat now, just show how dangerous it has become for people to live in Chicago, not only from the shootings, but from gentrification. It is all kinds of things, food deserts, whatever it may be. Anything other than what I saw on that Durham trailer that kind of put me in the mind of, do you remember that one, I'm Gonna Get You Sucker, by the Wyans Brothers, Delta? Delta, stay with me now.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry, my mute button hit it. I didn't know. I kind of remember that movie. That movie's mm-hmm. been a while ago, though, right?
Mm-hmm, yes. It's an old one.
Mm-hmm.
And it was kind of like, I forgot what kind of comedy you would call I'm Gonna Get You Sucker. But anyway, that trailer, that's kind of what it reminded me of. I'm kind of like, I'm kind of feeling more towards that boycott of that movie now anyway, because I rarely go to the theater now, because I tend to fall asleep in my older age. But, my goodness, I don't know.
Wesley Snipes is the star of the movie.
Well, and you know what? I think Angela Bassett. He has a nice cast. I mean, a really talented black cast.
Jennifer Hudson. She named quite a few of them.
Yeah.
Quite
a big fan of Jennifer Hudson. But yes. Quite a few stars. It's a nice all-star
cast. And a new little girl broke out from out of South Carolina. A new black girl, Spike Lee introduced.
Okay.
From South Carolina.
Hmm. And she's in the film.
She's
Charac.
In the movie, yeah. She's playing a great part in it.
Hmm.
So they did an interview with her on Wendy Williams.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm. But I really want to get my hot topics tonight, my good Black Rose, whenever you get a chance.
All right. What do you have for us, Jeff?
Oh, yeah.
Let's give out the number for people to call in first. 641-715-3660. And the code is 549032. Press pound. And *61 if you would like to comment. All right.
And then also, if anybody have any questions, y'all know you can write in and ask Delta Cougar whatever you want, and I will answer your letter. So just let me know. I think I had some come in.
Yes, you certainly did.
And I need to answer them too. But okay, let me give you my first hot topic. Y'all hold your weave on. And hold your drawers on. This is what the old folks used to say. I got some hot gossip. This is hot true gossip. And it's really kind of a sad story. This one is out in Kansas City.
Uh-huh.
It is a black gentleman. And you know, you don't hear too many black people out in Kansas City. You know, that's farmland. It's only 2% black out there. But anyway, this black man moves out there. He's a bail bondsman.
Okay.
He's 44 years old. His wife is 29. And his wife was homeschooling 8 kids. And 7 of the children was her stepchildren.
Mm-hmm.
And they lived in a $2 million home. And he had 2 white ladies work for them, babysitting and helping with the kids. And the police was called to the house because there was a disturbance, a call of a domestic disturbance where he was beating the wife. And while they was there, somebody alerted the police to go to the barn. He had a barn. And told them to go and look for the remains. It was 8 kids. And they said the kids never came outside in the yard or anything. They didn't allow them outside to play or anything. That was a red flag right there. And one of the children came up missing. And it was a little 7-year-old boy. The daddy beat the 7-year-old son to death. And fed him to his pig.
What?
Stop it. Stop it.
No. Candy, didn't I send it to you? I sent it to all y'all. I'm going to make sure you get it, Candy. A black man. He beat his wife, and I guess she got tired, and he beat the little boy to death. And he was a prominent businessman. And he took this child to keep police from finding out. He cut the child up and fed him to the pig. And they went in the barn and found half a human remains of the little boy. Pieces of, pieces of human remains of the little boy in Kansas City. To me, that is so heartbreaking. Imagine a 7-year-old child. You looking at your daddy beat you, then kill you. Then your daddy do the most ultimate thing is take you and feed you to his hog like you were nothing but slop and trash. Now that's heartbroken right there. So we need to talk about that tonight. And I love to hear the people respond on that one. Then also, we have a mother that was coming back from the casino. In some part of Mississippi, I forgot, around the Delta part. Uh-huh. And her and her son got into an argument. I guess she had been drinking, coming back from the casino. And see, everybody don't need to have a gun. Now, don't get me wrong. I believe in you toting a gun. If you're responsible. The mother pulls a gun, shoots her 21-year-old son in the head and kills him.
Oh, my goodness.
And shoots. And these are all our people right here I'm talking about. And shot his girlfriend.
Shot his girlfriend?
Shot the girlfriend too. She shot her son and shot his girlfriend. Driving in the car, they had him been to the casino. And she killed the son instant. The girl's friend was wounded severely. And see, some people, it's okay to own guns, but we got to be responsible how we use them guns. Alcohol and guns don't mix.
Sure enough.
Then we have another hot topic where a mother in Chicago, and I sent y'all this a year.
I hope she didn't kill her baby.
This mother said her son was viciously shot down like a dog too. And he is fighting in Chicago. He was killed before the other 16-year-old man, young man. And she's fighting to get the tape released, but they won't release it.
So does she have an attorney or someone that can help her fight to have the tape released? What's going on? Why isn't the tape being released?
I don't know. The city refused to release it. The city refused to release the tape.
So she has an attorney.
You got to get a seller's lawyer that can make the city say yeah when they want to say nay.
Certainly. Like when this judge was forced to demand the release of this tape of Laquan. Because it gets to a point where, somebody has to step in and just say, okay, listen, we're going to file, I think this man
but isn't it like public record for it to be released, y'all?
After a certain amount of time, it becomes public record. And so it has to be released, or it's available.
Then, can I give my last hot topic?
Yeah, come on, what you have for us?
Okay, well, tomorrow, we know during the killing of Freddie Gray, we have the first trial begin to start tomorrow.
Ooh.
So we need to keep a close eye on that. And we need to keep up with what's going on there. So that's something going to be in the news, getting ready. And then also, we need to see what's coming out with this Donald Trump tomorrow, with all these black preachers saying that he's having 100 black preachers going to endorse him tomorrow. So it's something that we need to keep up with. But if the black police endorse him, preachers, and you better believe it's money involved behind it.
Because all these black preachers are supposed to be mega preachers. Now, have they decided that they are going to endorse
that's
him?
What the face, that's what the news is saying on Facebook. They saying that they agreed to endorse him.
Okay, let's take a quick break and let me try to see if I pull up this story, and then we'll come right back with you,
look in your messages.
I remember hearing a story, but I don't know.
Just pull your message right quick.
It says no Donald Trump endorsement. No Donald Trump.
Donna Summer to be alive with you. Never to be you.
You are tuned in to the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasts and live program scheduling, visit us on the web at blacktalkradionetwork.com.
Okay, and we are back here at the Lotus Place. Let me see, I want to play this quick clip. Canty, you want to share something with us in reference to maybe what Delta spoke of, and then I'll play this quick clip regarding Chairman Fred Hampton.
When it comes to getting justice and the victims are black, the wheels of justice just don't seem to turn at all, especially if you don't have a social engineer for an attorney. And the prosecutor, they're not about to embarrass the police in state or that city. There's a universal thing. The police do not put, I mean, the DA do not put police in jail. And with this case coming up tomorrow in Baltimore, the special prosecutor for the state, well, for the city of Chicago, I mean, of Baltimore, she gave, put on a rich front. But if you know anyone who is a lawyer, if they can hear her opening remark, ask them if the jurors believe the prosecutor is going for a conviction. Just the very first day when the prosecutor presents the case, the jury knows just the way the prosecutor presented the case, if she's going for a conviction or an acquittal. Just the very way she presented this.
This article states several black pastors invited to meet with Donald Trump on Monday have denied reports that they had plans to endorse the presidential candidate at the event. And Trump's presidential ecclesiastical pimps, Trump's presidential campaign has canceled a press conference with Trump and those religious leaders. Bishop Clarence McClendon, a Los Angeles-based pastor who, like Trump, has appeared on reality television, was invited to the meeting but will not attend. The meeting was presented not as a meeting to endorse, but a meeting to engage in dialogue, he said on Facebook Friday. The Preachers of L.A. star said he will not make up his mind to endorse until January 2016. Bishop Coletta Vaughn, senior pastor of the Holy Ghost Cathedral and the star of Oxygen reality series Preachers of Detroit, said she was invited. I'm like, who is that? What comedian says the Holy Ghost Cathedral and the Temple of Zion and Mount Baptist laying on the cross and Jesus such and such? He just go on and on. You know all the names, Delta, that you guys have for your church. The Temple of Zion, Everlasting Morning Star, Shining Light, Guiding Light, Search to Tomorrow, and whatever. Anyway, Trump is an insult and embarrassment, but he represents the country we have become, she said. Flaunting a ticket of unbridled bigotry, sexism, racism, blah, blah, blah. The meeting was described by the campaign in a press release as a coalition of 100 African-American evangelical pastors and religious leaders who will endorse the GOP front runner after a private meeting at Trump Tower. Okay, so that's what these cats would call themselves.
But see, that was probably Trump them putting out them lies.
I believe he's talking. Good evening, everybody. Hey, bro.
Hey, Brown.
Talking. They were nipping at the bait. They were nipping at the bait, and he probably was offering them some serious money just to have an audience with them.
Mm-hmm.
And they're getting the willy nilly because they might fear their congregation, some of them in the congregation. Might just be enough to want to have that pastor fired. But now these pastors, they're so sure of themselves, they can do whatever they damn well please, and don't think they have to be held accountable to the members of their church. I mean, Bishop Eddie Long, I am surprised he still pastors his church after it was clear that he is guilty as charged of conduct on becoming a spiritual leader. And he still got his, he still can go up into that pulpit and members still give this man their money. And our people, like I said before, our people are religious, but they're not ethical.
That's yeah, he lost a lot of members, though. I know at one time, like, the church was, like, almost half empty.
Yeah, because he had, like, you right us here.
Yeah, I went,
like,
I
a
went
ghost
to that
town.
Church.
They say it's like a ghost town. It ain't like it used to be.
No, no,
and I'm
going to
tell you what. And what really made a lot of people leave is when Dr. Martin Luther King's daughter left.
Mm-hmm.
When she left,
well, she did. Bernie
a lot
yes,
of the
she
people left.
She said it wasn't due to that scandal, the latest scandal.
Well, she
but
a lie.
Yeah. She needed to
she
get out of there. But also, you know, he was caught up, Bishop Eddie Long's church was entangled in that financial scandal with that young man coming there, somebody coming there pretending to be a financial advisor, having those people invest in all this and that. See, they just have too much going on over there at that church. They're too suspicious.
Well, y'all remember about, I guess it's been about, it might have been 20 years ago, they had this thing going around in all the black churches about this networking scam. And what they used to do, they used to take all the preachers. It was going on all over the country. And the preachers would set up these financial meetings. The one of them was a pyramid scheme.
Hmm.
And you put in so much money, and then you have to bring in so many people under you. The more people you bring in, allegedly, the more money you get.
More money than church.
No, more money than church was getting because the church got a cut too. Well, the church's cut went to the pastor. Because he was the head of every church. In other words, if I start something at the top, and this is the way pyramid schemes work, because I used to be a conflict. If I start at the top, everybody that come under me, I get all your money. So you end up with nothing. And then the scheme is disbanded, but you can't get your money back. And a whole lot of black churches made money like, pastors made money like this by running that scam through the church. But, you know, it goes back to this, it goes back to the spirituality of our people. Now, we look at what happened in France. But you look at how the French oppressed the Haitian people. Now, it might have took 100 and some years for them to get even with the French. But don't ever think that my ancestors did not hold them responsible for what they did to the Haitian people. It took a while for that to come to fruition. But you see what's happening in France, man. All that hell and all that torment that they put upon the French, upon the Haitian people, not once, but twice, not three times. They lost two wars, and then they had the United States to put sanctions on them for 200 years. And that's what the French did to the African people that inhabited Haiti, that put them in an impoverished state right now to today. But you see how our ancestors worked? It might have took 200 years, but look how devastated they are now that they can't even go out of their own house they can't sit on that little Parisian or restaurant thing. Eat, eat their little food, you know.
Uh-huh. And losing then not all on their rights and freedom, the little bit that are left.
Right, and then not only that, look how much money they're spending because of this fear. See, and this is why I said these are our weapons. These are the weapons that we have. We don't need Donald Trump. We don't need dumbass Ben Carson. We don't need none of these people running around that's going to portray that they're going to do something for us. You know, everybody fell in love with President Obama as the first black president. Well, actually, they fell in love with Bill Clinton first. But anyway, none of these people who were placed in these positions gave a damn about African people in this country or abroad. So for us to continue to be dumbasses, excuse my language, and try to deal with a political arena where we can't even handle the problems of our own community makes us look very, very ignorant and stupid. See, like I said, I've been voting for Dr. King and Malcolm X for years. That is so I would stay a registered voter, because sometimes when you go places, people say, well, are you a registered voter? Sure I am. Yeah, they ain't gonna tell you who I vote for. Because it really don't make no difference, because nobody that I put in office is gonna do anything for me. But we have to understand the political game. We just sit up and listen to Ben Carson, who's black or African, and then just sit up and listen to Donald Trump, who's really nothing but a dumbass entertainer. Because nobody's going to endorse, no political party is going to really endorse Donald Trump. That's number one. Because Donald Trump does not have the legal savvy to even become a president. And if you look back at history, the majority of your presidents have a legal mind. Okay, the majority of them, they're lawyers. You wouldn't put Ben Carson with his retarded ass up there. He might be a good surgeon. But as far as running something like a country where he has no wherewithal whatsoever, nobody's going to endorse him. Now, the evangelical community put him up, because people have to realize when these guys acknowledge that they're going to run for president, they get Secret Service clearance or protection, and they get to keep some of that money that's given to them. And that's why they run. When Al Sharpton ran, when Jesse Jackson ran, they know they had no chance of winning. None whatsoever.
Not a snowball's chance in hell.
In hell.
But it gave them some political power, some clout, some connections, extra some money. So
here's what Jesse did when he ran under the Rainbow Coalition and did not get the nomination. He didn't run anyone else under the Rainbow Coalition. He sold the Rainbow Coalition and gave it to the gays. And he was never held accountable by the blacks in Chicago to not only sanction him, but to have him expelled as being unqualified for leading black people anywhere. How do you sell your trademark to an organization that has no affinity to black people when AIDS was raging in this country? White gays was only treating and giving information to themselves as to how to get the AIDS virus treated properly. Black gays was dropping like fleas. How many black churches lost their organs? They acquired the left sector. It was an epidemic. But these white gays did not give no information to the black gays as to how they could get help. But yet, Jesse gave the gays the trademark of the Rainbow Coalition.
Well, you know what? And speaking of that, just really quickly, and kind of like researching Chairman Fred Hampton's background, he's the one that actually, it seems like, he's the one that like came up with the Rainbow Coalition, like whole idea or theme, and then somehow Jesse Jackson adopted it. So maybe that's
how Jesse rose. That's how Jesse rose.
So maybe that's why he didn't mind giving it because he know he had co-opted it or stolen it or
something. And money under the table. Money under the table goes to its coffers. What has Operation Push accomplished, and where are they to deal with the police oppression out there in Chicago? What is their track record since he's head of Push?
Well, first of all,
I tell y'all something. Have y'all noticed Reverend Al Sharpton? There's no one on the scene. He's like, he's gone off the scene. You don't hear nobody about him. Nothing. It's like he don't even exist.
He has been exposed, and the rebels are fully aware that he has no clothes, and that he would be told to move on or die. He has
nobody's
no clothes.
Trying to be bothered with him.
He cannot bamboozle the masses of people. Only a few blacks who are still clinging to, well, maybe he got the answer, and looking for some fast money. But how many families, victims of police brutality, lost their loved ones? And all he could do, him and that damn Sanford Rubenstein, is to get you hush money. That's all Sharpton was noted for. Him and Rubenstein, they had, as he called it, an industry going, where they would pick and choose what it takes to take, but it was all only result was getting you hush money. Money that you would never ever see again in your lifetime, but your loved one died for nothing. And there's a case right down the block from where I live. The man would drive down from Connecticut, name was Shim Walker. He would drive down from Connecticut to check on his mom's, make sure drug dealers wasn't doing drugs on his mother's stoop. His mother's an amputee. Shim, on his paper night, sees a young man sitting on his mother's stoop. He saw another drug dealer, tells him, get off my mother's stoop. I don't like drug dealers on my mother's stoop. Said it three times. Don't you know this undercover cop, rather than show his shield, he could have just walked away. He didn't want Shim to know he was an undercover cop. He let Walker believe that he was a wise guy and wanted a demo. So he thought, let the drug dealer try to remove the drug dealer off his stoop. And the cop pulled out his gun, shoots him point blank, raising his chest, killing him instantly. Who preached the eulogy? Sharpton. Who's sitting behind Sharpton on the pulpit? On the pulpit. Sanford Rubenstein. Sharpton had a thing where he tells his pastor, move over. I'm coming to your church to do the eulogy. And the pastor had to say, okay. That's how he rolls. That's how he rolls. He told Calvin Odom's bus at Abyssinia. He told Calvin Odom's bus at Abyssinia, step aside. I'm coming to your church to run a rally in support of his former governor, George Pataki.
Hey, but I want to ask a question, y'all. Did Mike Brown mama ever get any money out the deal?
Of course she did.
Yeah, she got paid. The majority of the people that have had loved ones killed by police brutality, because they all citizens are bonded for millions and millions of dollars for casualties like that. They're bonded. They have bonds and they pay high insurance rates and to be able to pay for lawsuits. So when they said $10 million, $5 million, or $20 million, it doesn't hurt them. Nope. But they have a problem with the utilization of color of law, which means these police officers are protected because of them wearing a uniform and by them being in an office of the city, state, or federal government. So they're exonerated from prosecution. Now, they might bring them to trial, or they might go through the motions, but very rarely do you see them prosecuted for the murder of an African person. But as far as the money goes, they pay the money in a heartbeat, and they just put a clause in there. They put a gag order in there where you can't detail the outcomes of the settlement of the case, and they go ahead and pay you off. And
hey,
that's
Brown.
Legal.
Brown, how about this case? Okay,
go ahead. Let me finish. And that is legal to do that. It's legal for them to pay these families millions of dollars because normally the lawyer that's handling your case gets a third of the money, which makes him rich. The family gets the rest. The police officer or whoever's may be, is never prosecuted, never goes to jail, and he rides off into the sunset. And it's a continuous process until we understand. I'm going to say this and I'm going to shut up. Until we understand how to use our spiritual power through our ancestors and make these people suffer, then that's when we would get results.
You see, this case out there in Chicago, the family had not officially filed suit against the city for, what's the name, Daquan?
Laquan McDonald.
Laquan, yeah. Well, the family got $5 million and the family hadn't even sued the city of Chicago yet. And it was kept quiet for 400 days as to what the city was going to do about this killer cop. $5 million. And leave it to the mainstream media, they never tell you that this young man was kidnapped by the police, forced to get out in the middle of the road after he was taken from the east side of Chicago to the west side, and was in an unfamiliar territory, and was forced to get the car. You notice the film, he's running away from the police. And they shot that killer cop in 15 seconds. That killer cop shot that boy 16 times within 15 seconds. Mm-hmm. But he was kidnapped by the police, and that he was awarded the state, a foster child, was raped twice. I mean, when do you have black pastors that has the spine, the near spine of Adam Clayton Powell, Malcolm X, or Dr. King? These are three clergymen that did not maybe agree with tactics, but they were serious about our liberation and they were never for sale. Most of your pastors now are for sale. They're in it for the money. It's a racket that Dr. King denounced as being more cautious rather than courageous. You don't have no more Bill Jones. You don't have no more Sandy Ray. You don't have no more Milton Glamison. These were Hilton James. These were sterling practices in this region, rather, that didn't know their place, never knew to keep quiet, to be cautious rather than courageous. They was always courageous rather than cautious. These pastors today, they're going to meet. Only reason why they won't meet with Trump tomorrow, and it's called off because of the ramifications it's going to have, where they fear that when they come to their church, the locks might be changed.
Well, did anybody see that it seems like the Black Friday profits were like over $1 billion lower than last year? Over $1 billion decrease?
Yeah. Brought it on a financial report the other day. That means that people are really, really scared. And it's not just a boycott of our people. White people are scared of the political arena right now because the rich white people are holding their money. Because they don't know what this country is going to be like after Obama leaves. See, they are very tactful in understanding that they own the political arena. And it's two sides to their political arena. And we're not even in the equation. We're just pawns on the game of chess. And if anybody know anything about chess, that's the first person you get really is your pawn. He's indispensable. And that's how white people think about us. We are indispensable to them. They have no more use for us in America. So we might as well get with the program and stop BSing. They have no use for us. They will continue to do what they do. And we will not change our ways and adapt to the ways of our ancestors. See, when the blueprint has been laid out for you, like Marcus Garvey laid out, Amos Wilson laid out, Prodigy Woodson laid out, these were prophetic messages for black people. I was telling you about that book the other night, The Black Bourgeoisie by E. Franklin Frazier, where he attacked the clergy. You know, he attacked the black clergy at that time, which basically consisted of the Black Baptist Church, because they put themselves on a pedestal. And today we see these mega churches popping up all, especially in the South and in major cities, you know. And I remember back in the early stages of the Bill Clinton, and I'm gonna give y'all a date, and if you got a computer, can type in C-SPAN, and you can type the date that I'm going to give you, and you can see what we're doing. I did a two-hour stint on C-SPAN back in 1997, try to protect public people that live in public housing, okay, because they had something going on in the Bush administration at the time called Hope 6. But anyway, these pastors during the Clinton administration, well, it might have been the early stages of the Bush administration, they were given exorbitant amounts of money to start different elements under their church. And they had this lady, and I can't remember her name, but she was the forerunner. I think she was the governor of New Jersey at the time. Her name was Christine something. I can't remember her name. But anyway, there was a lot of black churches in New Jersey where they started setting up these churches as businesses and making the pastors CEOs. And they were loaning these, they had these loan companies. They had an agreement with the bank that if you had a certain amount of denominated people under your banner, that you would be able to borrow as much as you need. And that would keep our people deaf, dumb, and blind. Because they know that the pastor in the community will always be able to have the power to sway their congregation. It's all a big game, people. It's one of the biggest con games going. And we continue to fall for it. We continue to fall for it. And it has nothing to do. It has nothing to do with a person's relationship with God or the Creator. But it has everything to do with us not knowing where this stuff comes from. You know, and it's time that we think very intelligently and understand that we have to be able to ask questions. See, I used to tell my kids when they were coming up and they were little kids growing up, there's never a question that's too stupid to ask that can't deserve an intelligent answer. And if you ask any pastor, not put anyone to the test, ask your pastor where did Christianity originate from and see what kind of answer you get. If he doesn't tell you anything about the Church of Nicaea and the Nicene Council, then you need to get your hand passed up and walk off. Because he's lying to you. If he doesn't tell you about anything about
it. Many people will not go into all of that. You know how they are, Brother Brown.
I'm just saying
about those pastors.
Oh, no, they're not going to do it.
Many of them want to keep them in the dark.
It's a spirit of fear. If you
too much money, too much money at stake. And I need to also know the history of these pastors. Back in slavery, they weren't called pastors, they were called parson. Parson was created by the slave master to make sure his slaves was willing to go along with the slave conditions and take the punishment, and to know that when they died, they were going to go to heaven. Just don't kill the slave master, don't steal any chickens or eggs, or don't kill the hogs, and above all, don't kill the slave master. And you see a good donkey, get baptized and remove your sin because your sin is black, and don't do anything to upset the system of slavery. And these parson was given the finest clothing by the slave master. His house was set aside from the slave quarters. It was called the same thing, the slave is called the same thing today if the church owns the property. His was parsonage. And most of our people don't know that the original pastors, they were not called pastors, they were called parsons. And our people need to know the history of these guys because most of these pastors are modern day parsons and have now morphed into becoming ecclesiastical pimps in overdrive. Boys. There is still, I know a professor right now, right on the block where I live, he got his congregation, moved with him to South Africa, spending $3,000 to go to South Africa to set up a church. Not caring about the ANC, but since the ANC sold out the people and the people are now praying for a revolution in South Africa.
And in Burkina Faso, and all around the continent, because you have these corrupt African leaders in many of these countries that are still tied to France. So
yes.
We'll be right back. Let's take a quick break, and we're going to come back, and I'm going to go into our topic of Fred Hampton and Ta-Nehisi Coates' book.
Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
You're basically knowing my ideology, basically, you know, me on yours, you can support some of our programs, that's what I'm saying.
Why not?
And we believe in programs like the Best for Children program, and, you know what I'm saying? Right on, brother?
We believe they're good things.
Uh-huh.
As a focal point to organize their mothers and fathers.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. There's no educational program here?
That's come out of social life. You know, you set that up, but I mean, we can't put everything on one piece of paper.
What about this bank?
Credit Union?
Mm-hmm.
Credit Union. Credit Union, my brother. Are you hip to a credit union?
It is a bank.
Yeah,
are you going by money?
Yeah, it is a bank. Owned by the people, run for the people, and by the people.
What will money be given out to people?
Well, the people would say that,
you want to buy,
you know, whatever, you know, the people in the community.
You need some living room furniture, maybe? You need a car, maybe?
See, I got, the thing is with me, you dig, I need to know some more about it. I wish you had some more diligence about the education thing. Because, you dig, as far as we're concerned, the struggle, the way you look at struggle, is that this depends on the education thing.
Because this depends on the education. Well, the whole thing.
No, but in this, you can call him this with no education.
Not the way we're talking about forming. You know, right. We're talking about forming it right. You know, it's not on the paper. We didn't write it on the paper.
Forming right.
No.
Let me give you an example. Yomo Kenyatta formed the excellent revolution with no education. And all he did at the end say, Yomo told the motherfucker, I said, well, you know, you can educate, hate the enemy, but I'm your brother. I helped him lead the revolution. Now I'm more precious. Another example, Papa Doc in Haiti. Papa Doc in Haiti hated everything white. Man, you couldn't put the white paper in front of Papa Doc's face. But he moved all the white people out and he took over and be a president. Called no education. And the people have been educated, they just said that we don't hate the motherfucker white people, we hate the oppressor, whether he be white, black, brown, or yellow. We got to know your educational program to find out what it's gonna be in the finale. A lot of people Yomo Kenyatta is called not a never revolutionary, but an ex revolutionary. So it's Papa Doc. They brought on successful revolution. That thing in under 9 miles was a bit. Bantu freaking fighters, all that kind of action. What we're saying is the end. But you don't judge Castro now. You can't do it. Nobody in this room can judge whether Castro's going to be a revolutionary or not. You know what I mean? We're talking about things, you know what I mean? China, the People's Republic, and even the things in here now, talking about even going on further into a communist state. That's what we're talking about. That was a revolutionary. But we got to understand here the educational program that you have to be able to figure out whether it will go on the right lines, where the people will end up in a situation where they can be able to really control themselves. You understand what I'm saying? With no education, the people take this local foundation and start stealing money because they won't be really educated to why it's the people thing anyway. You understand what I'm saying? With no education, you have neo-colonialism instead of colonialism like you got in Africa 9, like you got in Haiti. So what we're talking about is there has to be an educational program. That's very important. Matter of fact, we're so important for us that a person has to go through 6 weeks of our political education before he can consider himself a member of the party, able to even run down ideology for the party. Why? Because if they don't have an education, then they're nowhere. You see what I'm saying? They're nowhere because they don't even know why they're doing what they're doing. You might get people caught up in an emotionless movement. You understand? You might get them caught up in cause they're poor and they want something. And then if they're not educated, they want more. And before you know it, they'll be captive. Before you know it, we have Negro imperialism.
Do you think you're free, Officer Dunn?
Yes, I think I'm free.
No more questions, Officer Dunn. God help
you. So we say, we always say to Black Panther Party that they can do anything they want you to. We might not be back. I might be in jail. I might be anywhere. But when I leave, you can remember I said with the last words on my lips that I am a revolutionary. And you're going to have to keep on saying that. You're going to have to say that I am a proletarian. I am the people. I'm not the pig. You've got to make a distinction. And the people are going to have to attack the pig. The people are going to have to stand up against the pig. That's what the Panthers are doing. That's what the Panthers are doing all over the world.
We have brought to trial here Fred Hampton. You are here to judge between two conflicting testimonies. Somebody is lying. Now, reason stands. Reason is very clear here. That Private Jones, who had come from Sanford, North Carolina, would have no great desire to see Fred Hampton up in this trial. But Fred Hampton, a key figure in this community, has great reason for not wanting to be put in jail.
But the state's attorney and the state's attorney's office has reasons to see Fred Hampton in jail. We've got a new state's attorney. And he said already what he thought about people that had different political beliefs than he had. His speeches sound somewhat like those of Hitler. And we know why he wants to see Fred Hampton put in jail. Why do I have a lot of arrests? Because of harassment. Why is that harassment? Because the people that harassed me have set up a problem that made me disagree with them violently. And they set up this problem in order to exploit me and other people like me. And why they want to get rid of me, because I'm saying something that might wake up some other exploited people and some other oppressed people, and if all these people ever get together, then these pigs that are exploiting us, we'll be able to run them into the lake. That's why they want to get rid of us. And it's just, it's sort of like a primary thing with me. I'm the first move to their make. I'm a part of an organization who will be the first organization they'll move on, because I happen to be a part of an organization, the Black Panther Party, that is the only organization, in fact, that has came out and stood up loud and clear saying that we don't care what anybody says, whether they have guns or not, and badges or 18 uniforms, if whenever they step outside the bounds of legality into the bounds of illegality, then we'll blow their brains out if they're bothering the people. And what makes them mad about that? They're constantly bothering the people. Anybody that's out there for the protection of the people happens to be in direct conflict with them. What makes them mad about it? What makes them mad about it is that they have black people and white poor people and red poor people and Puerto Rican poor people and Latin American poor Rican people of poor people of all descent. They have them caught up in their movements based on racism when the Black Panther Party stood up and said that we don't care what anybody says. We don't think you're fighting fire with fire vests. We think you're fighting fire with water vests. We're going to fight racism, not with racism, but we're going to fight with solidarity. We said we're not going to fight capitalism with black capitalism, but we're going to fight with socialism. We stood up and said we're not going to fight reactionary pigs and reactionary state attorneys like this and reactionary state attorneys like Hanrahan with any other reactions on our part. We're going to fight their reactions with all of those people to get together and have an international post-hand revolution.
Right on.
And that's saying all power to people.
Right on.
That's saying that no matter what color you are, you're just going through class. And that's saying there's a class over here and there's a class over there. And the reason is this class over here has never did anything to get this class off his back, because this is lower, this is upper. This is the oppressed, this is the oppressor. This is the exploited, this is the exploiter. And these people in this class have divided themselves and say, I'm black and I hate white people. I'm white and I hate black people. I'm Latin American and I hate hillbillies. I'm hillbillies and I hate Indians. So we fight amongst each other. And you heard the testimony of pigs here, and you got pigs of all colors, you know that. You got pigs that are white, you got pigs that are black. You even got pigs that are black and white. Propagating the same type of madness that this buffoon Hanrahan would be propagating if he were here himself. And why? Because they want to keep you to believing that I'm your enemy, and that everybody else that's black and that wears a lot of hair on his head and hair on his face, they want to keep you thinking that he's your enemy. Why? Because if ever you would disregard him and overlook him just for a minute, and throw away that question of racism and start dealing with a little logic, then there would be no one else you could attack other than Hand to Hand, other than Davy, and other than Tricky Dicky Mixon.
if you make the right decisions and the oppressed people of the world get complete satisfaction. I know you return a verdict of not guilty. Thank you.
And you are listening to The Lotus Place, and we are honoring Chairman Fred Hampton from out of Illinois, Chicago, Illinois. Let me see. That was a clip. Part of that clip was from him speaking in the courtroom. Fred Hampton, like many of the brothers and sisters of the Move organization in Philadelphia, were going to the courtroom and defend themselves. They were very, very articulate and very knowledgeable of the law. And we have our legal eagle on the line too, Brother Brown. Brother Brown, you want to share any comments about Chairman Fred Hampton, and particularly in light of what was revealed, the video that was revealed in Chicago this weekend? Fred Hampton, back in 1969, was assassinated in his bedroom with his pregnant wife and also his comrade, Mark Clark. Police came in, of course, they lied like Fred Hampton and Mark Clark were shooting at them, which in actuality was found that only one bullet came from out of the house, and all of the bullets. I think that was one of the first times I first started paying attention to like forensic science by watching the video and how they stuck what do they call it? The shooter sticks? I can't think of what they call those. But, you know, to show the aim of the bullets, how the bullets penetrated the wall.
By projection sticks.
Projection sticks, thank you. I think that's when I became interested in forensics, when I watched that. And so, you know, when people think about how vicious and brutal it was for Laquan McDonald to be shot down in the street, Brother Brown, when you go all the way back to 1969 and even before then, like we mentioned with Ida B. Wells fighting, they've been doing all of this. It's nothing new. Except for the camera. What say you? You have a comment to offer?
Well, you know, for a long time, we did not. As being a member of the party, and I think I joined during that period of time when I was in the 10th grade. But when that happened, you have to remember there was an incident that happened prior to that with Bunchy Carter out in Oakland. Mm-hmm. And they killed Bunchy Carter in the same manner. Police mm-hmm. killed him. And what the attack upon the Black Panther Party was, because one of the elements that they understood wholeheartedly that we had not understood in the Black community was the armed struggle of our people. See, we had a right. When they protected Betty Shabazz when she went out there to the college and you saw them on the steps with those weapons, okay, then they had a right to carry weapons. Now, what had happened in the past, they had been using laws against Black people that dated all the way back to slavery that did not allow Black men to own weapons. So what they did, they researched the law books, and they started carrying weapons openly. And that's when Ronald Reagan said that we're going to have to launch an all-out attack on them. And when he forwarded this to J. Edgar Hoover, it was almost like a done deal. Now, there were a lot of provocateurs that infiltrated the party. You understand me? And when you talk about provocateurs, that these are people that come along and they see you moving in a certain direction, and they are planning in your organization to destroy you from the inside. Well, the reason that Fred Hampton couldn't even answer the door or respond to the police, because he had drank some Kool-Aid that night in the presence of a Black Panther, or what he thought was a comrade, who was actually a provocateur who was paid to put Secanol, which was a painkiller, in his Kool-Aid. So that it was just like Percocet. So when he drank the Kool-Aid and he went to sleep, he couldn't respond.
Right. And
nobody knows
the person's name, but he was offered a chance to have his charges reduced. So he went along with it.
Right, right. And see, that's you have to be very careful of people who put themselves out there like they have done so much. Mm-hmm. And they come in wolf, they sheep that come in wolf's clothing. And when you see people say, well, I did this and I did this and I did this, and they have no results or what they say they did. I'm not just talking about appearing on Facebook, appearing on YouTube, or Skype, or all the other bullshit, excuse my language. I'm talking about people who have actually been in the community that have recognition from people.
Mm-hmm.
See, that is the hard thing. I think they're showing there in Baltimore with these people. No, that's in France. I was looking at and got a TV on mute. But you know, it was people like that. I remember when they infiltrated the Black Panther Party in the city of Norfolk, where they tried to infiltrate it. But the brothers were just so strong, you know, they never could actually infiltrate it to the degree that they could break it up. They broke up upon themselves. But, you know, they had one of the guys that actually groomed me and got me started years ago in trying to understand the law. His name was Andrew Bogle, one of the best paralegals that never was able to take the bar because black lawyers did not want him to work under them. So they had a thing in the state of Virginia where I could work under lawyers for 3 years, and he would sign off on the thing they had trained me to do. And you didn't need to go to law school. But certain people like that, as such as myself, they would not let us do that because we were revolutionaries. And they did not want a revolutionary person with that kind of mindset to be able to have the legal aspects of going into the courtroom in certain manners. So, you know, they had a lot of Panthers. Huey Newton was one. He was a law student, and he was very articulate in his speech. If you ever listen to Huey Newton's speeches, his articulation of speech was eloquent, you know. And they annihilated us. They annihilated us. And I remember one time that somebody had, I don't know how they found out about my affiliation in the past, but I was at work. And this guy walked up to me, and he was a white guy. And he asked me, he said, can I ask you a question? And I said, yeah. And he said, somebody said that you was a Black Panther. You know, Black Panthers were people that hate white people. And I asked him, I said, well, who told you that? And he said, well, you know, I just assumed. I said, have you ever read anything in the literature on the Black Panther Party? And he said, not really. I said, what you need to do is go read some literature. Don't come to me with no stupid stuff. And then maybe we can sit down and have a dialogue. And he said, well, are there any Black Panthers left today? And I said, many are few and few are many. And I walked away from it. And, you know, I had been attacked on the job several times, even by my own people making stupid statements, you know, after seeing me do some stuff in the public. And, you know, I learned from what happened to Fred Hampton and Mark Clark. I just never give people that opportunity to get that close to me. I don't care if I don't have any friends. I'm not interested in a whole lot of friends. You know, and I believe my ancestors put people in my life that I can trust, and that's not a whole lot of them. Especially when it comes to these Negro organizations and these Negro preachers. You know, we had a preacher one time that he wouldn't meet with us unless it was at night.
Go back to Fred Hampton.
Yeah. And, you know, Fred Hampton was way ahead of his time in thought process. And, you know, his revolutionary mindset. And you hear me talk outside of the telephone in person. And when you got that mindset, you never get rid of it. You continue to let that, you're always a revolutionary. That means your wheels are always spinning. You're always thinking. You're always thinking for the people. And you put yourself, whatever you do, you'll always be there for the people. And that's what he was talking about, power. That's why they had their slogan, Power to the People, because they wanted the people to know that whatever they needed, that the Panther Party was always there for, at their disposal. And that's not happening today. There are very few organizations that are making themselves disposable to our people.
Yeah, and you may see individual people doing this or that, people working in their own little silos. They have this and that. I think I saw a video of Snoop Dogg, or whatever he calls himself now. He gave out some turkeys. And then, like, last year during the Ferguson demonstrations, John Legend, he and his fiance provided a food truck. But if all of these people were really combined, a lot of these efforts, in addition to continuing to do the individual work in their cities or where the work is needed, but I know that we could be a lot more effective. Like this movie, what did you think about the Chirac movie, about Spike Lee's new movie, Chirac? Have you seen a trailer of it, Brother Brown?
Not sure.
Oh my God! I don't know what's going on with that one.
What is it about?
Well, it's supposed to be about Chicago, and
it's
gonna be
about all them gang violence.
Well, one of the things I want to say about gang violence is this. These gangs that are out there, they are misguided young warriors that have no direction. See, when you are left to feed for your own like an animal, mm-hmm. and there is no man in the household, there's nobody to guide you.
Uh-huh.
And mama have been messed up on drugs, which was planted in the community. You know, we have to start weighing in on all these factors of the genocide effect on our people. See, crack was not an accident. Neither is it heroin they're cutting up with painkillers. It's not an accident. Now, who would have thought of taking heroin and mixing it with crushed up Percocet and creating, now they got heroin that's coming, somebody's making it into a pill. It looks just like a Percocet.
Yeah.
And they're selling it for like $25 a piece. So, I mean, you don't come up with this idea sitting in the hood, you understand me, with a kitchen chair in front of the door watching the police. So you don't come up with these kind of diabolical schemes to transform chemicals. Because very few people that ain't got no degree are chemists. If you ain't got no degree, excuse my language. You don't know how to take no aspirin and make no, you wouldn't know how to take baking soda and mix it with cocaine and produce crack. Let's put it like that. So the gangs are being fed the guns and the drugs as tools of means to economic ends. See, again, when they came around with certain federal laws under the Clinton administration to destroy gangs, and stuff of this nature. Well, they still don't understand. Now, me, Tukey Williams, and me, Abu Jamal are the same age. Unfortunately, Tukey Williams died. He was executed before he was given a chance to even prove his innocence. And Mumia is still in jail. Well, all of us are the same age. All of us joined the Black Panthers at the same time. Tukey Williams was in Oakland, Mumia was in Philadelphia, and I was in North. But the mindset that was put in our minds at that time by older cats that was in the party was not one of destruction. You know? So when Tukey Williams started the Blood of the Crips or whatever he started, it came about as a result of changing your mindset. And, you know, what's happening today with these gangs is that, number one, these young brothers are totally out of control for one reason, because they didn't have any guidance during their youth. As opposed to when we were young, the guys that were Panthers and stuff took us off the street, and they educated us to a degree about who we were, gave us some self-worth, and let us know who our oppressors were. You know, and you have guys like Rap Brown, these guys wrote books of knowledge. That Nigga Die, Soul on Ice, these were in books by Ice Person. These were the first educators of my mind when I was 16 years old.
I remember reading Iceberg Slim.
I read all of his books before I was 17 years old. I would take them to school with me and read them. People didn't know what the hell they were. But I read them.
Let me play this one right here by Fred Hampton, Brother Brown. Let's see.
And then I will elaborate. Then I would like to elaborate on it, because there's a lot of things that he says that people today are not aware of how they were used. And, you know, you have to put these things in their proper perspective, because this brother was a prophet. His messages were prophetic elements that the ancestors had given him to show our people. The same thing with the book that Huey Newton called Revolutionary Suicide. That was a very articulate book that Huey Newton wrote. I think he wrote part of it while he was incarcerated.
Sorry about that, Brother Brown. You said you believe he wrote part of it while he was incarcerated?
I think he wrote part of Revolutionary Suicide when he was incarcerated. And he finished it when he got out. I had a copy of it. I think it's in my storage shed, but that's one book that I would go back to periodically to get elements of revolutionary thought to keep in mind on how to motivate our people. But you can go ahead and play the clip and then
I'm gonna give you the date
that you can go on the internet and pull up on C-SPAN and type in that date, and then you can see my two hour dialogue about public housing.
Okay, yes. Give us that date when you find it. All right, let's play this one. This is like a clip, just kind of giving a synopsis of revolutionary leader Chairman Fred Hampton.
Okay.
A nation who doesn't remember its fallen soldiers will never rise. According to the Webster's English Dictionary, the definition of a martyr is one who was put to death or endures great suffering on behalf of any belief, principle, or cause. This definition is most befitting to one of our greatest ancestors in a long lineage of noble warriors. The one we speak of is the revolutionary Fred Hampton.
If you work with anybody who's on coalition with anybody that has revolution on their mind. We're not a racist organization because we understand that racism is an excuse used for capitalism. And we know that racism is just a byproduct of capitalism. Everything would be all right if everything was put back in the hands of the people. And we're going to have to put it back in the hands of the people. And why they want to get rid of me? Because I'm saying something that might wake up some other exploited people and some other oppressed people. And if all these people ever get together, then these things that are exploiting us will be able to run into the lake. That's why they want to get rid of us.
Fred Hampton was born August 30th, 1948, and was raised in the Maywood suburbs of Chicago. He was an excellent student who was known and loved by many in his community. At an early age, he joined the fight for equality and freedom for his people. He was only 17 when he joined the NAACP and eventually became youth president of the Illinois chapter. He was a master orator, full of charisma. As a teenager, he organized over 500 black youth to lobby city officials to improve the academic and recreational institutions in the black community. And in 1968, like many other young black activists, he became disenchanted with the NAACP, and he joined the Black Panther Party.
You dare to struggle, you dare to win. If you dare not to struggle, then goddamn it, you don't deserve to win. Let me send peace to you if you're willing to fight for it.
The dark brown shades of my skin only add color to my tears. The crash against my hollow bones that rocks my soul.
In America, black people are treated very much as the Vietnamese people or any other colonized people, because we're used, we're brutalized, the police in our community occupy our area, our community as a foreign troop occupies territory. And the police are there not to, in our community, not to promote our welfare or for our security and our safety, but they're there to contain us, to brutalize us and murder us, because they have their orders to do so. And just as the soldiers in Vietnam have their orders to destroy the Vietnamese people.
Once again, his charisma and orator skills shot him through the ranks of the Black Panther Party. He eventually became the deputy minister. Under his leadership, the People's Clinic excelled, and the breakfast program for children reached new heights.
People learn by example. I don't think anybody has knowledge of that. I think that what he used to do said that people learn basically by observation and participation. I think that everybody caught on to that. So what we're saying there simply is that if they learn by observation and participation, then we need to do more acting than we need to do writing. And I think the Black Panther Party is doing that. That we didn't talk about a Breakfast for Children program, we've got one.
Come on in, little brother. Come on in, little sister. Y'all can sit down and get something to eat.
Due to his dynamic ability to organize and mobilize, he quickly became chairman of the Black Panther Party.
See, I got it. The thing is with me, Dig, I need to know some more about it. I wish you had some more ability about the education thing. Because, you dig, as far as we're concerned, the struggle, the way we look at struggle, is that this depends on the education thing, you dig. Because
this depends on the education. Well, the whole thing.
No, but in the end, this does. You can form this with no education.
Not the way we talk about forming.
You know, right. We're talking about forming it. Right. You know, it's not on the paper. We didn't write it on the paper.
Forming right.
No.
Let me give you an example. Yomo Kenyatta formed the excellent revolution with no education. And on the day of the end, Yomo told the motherfucker, I said, well, you know, you can educate, hate the enemy, but I'm your brother. I'll help you beat the revolution. Now I'm more pressure. Another example, Papa Doc in Haiti. Papa Doc in Haiti hated everything white. Man, you couldn't put this white paper in front of Papa Doc's face. But he moved all the white people out and he took over and be a president. He did, causing no education. And the people have been educated, they just said that we don't hate the motherfucking white people, we hate the oppressors, whether he be white, black, brown, or yellow. We got to know your educational program to find out what is going to be in the finale. A lot of people, what Yomo Kenyatta is called not a never a revolutionary, but an ex-revolutionary. So it's Papa Doc. They brought on successful revolution. That thing in the mouth was a bitch. Bantu freedom fighters, all that kind of action. What we're saying is the end. That you don't judge Castro now. You can't do it. Nobody in this room could judge whether Castro's going to be a revolutionary or not. You know what I mean? We're talking about things, you know what I mean, with China, the People's Republic, and even at the stage they're in now, talking about even going on further into a communistic state. That's what we're talking about. That was a revolutionary. So we got to understand here the educational program that you have to be able to figure out whether it will go on the right lines, where the people will end up in a situation where they can be able to really control themselves. You understand what I'm saying? With no education, the people take this local foundation and start stealing money because they won't be really educated to why it's a people thing anyway. You understand what I'm saying? With no education, you have neo-colonialism instead of colonialism like you got in Africa now, like you got in Haiti. So what we're talking about is there has to be an educational program. That's very important. Matter of fact, we're so important with us that a person has to go through 6 weeks of our political education before he can consider himself a member of the party, able to even run down ideology for the party. Why? Because if they don't have an education, then they're nowhere. You know what I'm saying? They're nowhere because they don't even know why they're doing what they're doing. You might get people caught up in an emotionless movement. You understand me? You might get them caught up in because they're poor and they want something. And then if they're not educated, they want more. And before you know it, they'll be capitalist. And before you know it, we have Negro imperialists.
He began to cross color lines, organizing different ethnicities and educating them about class and how it affects all people.
Now, we say all power to all people. We say white power to white people.
White power to
white. Brown power to brown.
Brown.
Yellow power to yellow people.
Yellow power.
Black power to black people.
Black power.
All power to people. That's saying that no matter what color you are, you're just running through class. And that's saying there's a class over here and there's a class over there. And the reason is this class over here has never did anything to get this class off its back because this is lower, this is upper. This is the oppressed, this is the oppressor, this is the exploited, this is the exploiter. And these people, this class have divided themselves. They say, I'm black and I hate white people. I'm white and I hate black people. I'm Latin American and I hate hillbillies. I'm hillbillies and I hate Indians. So we fight amongst each other.
This became known as the Rainbow Coalition. He collaborated with the Young Lords, a Puerto Rican organization, the Blackstone Rangers, a well-known street gang, Students for Democratic Society, just to name a few. This name and concept would eventually be adopted by Jesse Jackson. But the root of this concept began with Fred Hampton. And what made this man a powerhouse? His organizational skills were not limited to politics. He also orchestrated several gang truces around Chicago, encouraging them to uplift the black community, not tear it down. This is one of many qualities that led to severe hostility from the FBI and the Chicago Police Department in the COINTELPRO, counterintelligence program. Sanctioned by the United States government, J. Edgar Hoover launched the FBI to bring down and destroy the efforts of the Black Panther Party. Their goal was to rid the possibility of any Black Messiah arising. That's one that would rid the dysfunctions in their community, and one that would unify the people for change against the system of oppression. Hoover and the U.S. government fully understood that their prison system was available at their disposal to silence anyone who was looking to create change, especially revolutionary change. With Fred being such an agent of change that could mobilize people into action, he was definitely included amongst those arrested. He was arrested on trumped up charges for robbing a store for $71 worth of ice cream bars. Yes. After being released, he went back to work immediately, working for the revolution. As Fred Hampton intensified in his efforts, so did the Chicago police and FBI. This led to the recruitment of William O'Neill by the FBI.
My recruitment by the FBI was very efficient, very simple, really. I'd stolen a car and went joyriding over the state limit, and they had a potential case against me, and I was looking for an opportunity to work it off. And a couple of months later, that opportunity came when FBI agent Roy Mitchell asked me to go down to the local office of the Black Panther Party and try to gain membership.
He was able to get close up on Chairman Fred, even becoming one of his bodyguards.
Well, you're very confident that nobody's coming in the front door. Nobody getting on the roof.
Believe in fire, cover, and
William O'Neill, on December 3rd, slipped a barbiturate into the drink of Fred Hampton, ensuring that he would be asleep for the mass murder prepared by the police department. On December 4th, at 4:30 a.m., a pre-dawn raid took place at 2337 West Monroe Street. 12 officers opened fire, assassinating Fred Hampton while laying in bed with his girlfriend, Deborah Johnson. In this raid, Fred Hampton and Mark Clark were both assassinated. Deborah Johnson, his girlfriend, along with four others, survived but were seriously wounded.
Pigs kept on shooting. So I kept on hollering out. Finally, it stopped. They pushed me and the other brother by the kitchen door and told us to face the wall. Heard a pig say, "He's barely alive, he'll barely make it." I assumed they were talking about Chairman Fred. So then they started shooting the pig, they started shooting again. I heard a sister scream. They stopped shooting. The pig said, "He's good and dead now." Pigs running around laughing. They were really happy, you know, talking about Chairman Fred's dead. I never saw Chairman Fred again.
This raid was ordered by the FBI, carried out by the Chicago Police and Cook County, Illinois State Department office, led by Edward Hanoran. This brutal act of state repression took the lives of one of the greatest revolutionary fighters at the tender age of 21. Although he died young, he left a lifetime of work and a legacy. Over 5,000 mourners attended his funeral. Many argue that Chicago would be a different place if Fred Hampton were still here to continue the revolution.
They came in our community just like a thief in the night. And they just snatched Fred's life just like that, you know. And it's just like, why? This brother has done nothing to none of y'all. The only thing that this brother has done was to instill a sense of pride and dignity and self-determination in his people.
This great leader gave his life for millions of black people in America today. But as Fred Hampton said,
I might not be back. I might be in jail. I might be anywhere. But when I leave, you can remember I said with the last words on my lips, I am a revolutionary.
I don't believe I'm gonna die because I got a bad heart. I don't believe I'm gonna die because of lung cancer. I believe that I'm going to be able to die what I was just going to say that I was born for. I believe that I'm going to be able to die high off the people. I believe that I will be able to die as a revolutionary in the International Revolutionary Protest Struggle. And I hope that each one of you will be able to die in the International Protest Revolutionary Struggle, even if you're living. And I think this struggle is going to come. Why don't you live for the people? Why don't you struggle for the people? Why don't you die for the people?
You know, during Black History Month, people like Chairman Fred Hampton were never mentioned. We were always given, of course, Dr. King. And then I remember eventually we were able to write on Malcolm. But people like Chairman Fred Hampton and Huey P. Newton, you would hear about the Black Panthers in school, but you were mostly told by teachers that, oh, they were troublemakers. There was never a discussion around how the breakfast program was started and how intelligent these people were, so knowledgeable enough to go in the courtrooms and successfully defend themselves and actually lobbying for some extremely positive changes in our community. Canty, you still there with us? King B?
Yes, I'm here.
King B.
I'm here. Hello.
Yes. So, King B.
I'm reliving this incident with Fred Hampton. And Dick Gregory told Fred, man, he's going to kill you because he knew that Fred would not waver. He wouldn't bow. He didn't compromise. And to get away with killing not only him, but his running partner, Mark Clark, while they were in bed.
Mm-hmm.
It's just awful.
Mm-hmm. And these, and what's so beautiful and amazing about it all is these brothers were very, very young and had such a worldly sense and could articulate the problem in such a way that even the goats could get it. And these people could really relate to the community and the plight of the community. Because now I've heard many people speak, well, not many. I've heard some people actually analyze Dr. King's speeches. And if you listen to some of Dr. King's speeches, he just, in a sense, separate himself from the people. Like he would say, like, the Negro people in his speeches, if you listen. And some people will actually critique his speeches and saying that he separated himself because he was of the quote-unquote, you know, bourgeois black. He was a young minister, pretty affluent, in a sense, for black people. So he, you know, went to Morehouse, of course. And so he was somewhat separate from the majority of the black people. So, I mean, what are your thoughts on that, Canty? Have you ever noticed that in his speeches, or Brother Brown or Mother Delta?
Well, one of the things about Dr. King was that he, at one time, I think he got his doctorate from a Northern White University. And it was prior to him.
Boston.
Yeah.
I think it was like and, Boston University.
Right.
Uh-huh.
And he, because of his prowess in the pulpit, and he was picked to go to that school, he was accepted by that white school. He had actually dated a white girl. And the relationship was very, very aspiring, so he thought,
uh-huh.
until she was told not to associate with him anymore. And he ended up dating Coretta, and they ended up getting married. Dr. King's downfall in trying to be an assimilationist put him in a position that, you know, like E. Franklin Frazier said in the Black Bourgeoisie, you have to get that book, Sister Cheryl, as soon as you can. He elevated himself by surrounding himself with people of the clergy.
Oh.
And at that time, they were people who, after the Montgomery bus boycott, decided that when they created this SCLC, when Dr. King walked away from the NAACP, because they turned their backs on him during the Montgomery bus boycott. But there was a preacher that came before him that he took over the church, and his name was Reverend John. And Reverend John was a very, very fiery preacher. Yep. And he was the one that was no nonsense. You know, he did not go along with white folks. He stood his position. And, you know, the Baptist community kicked him out of the church.
Yeah, was totally for supporting a young woman in his congregation that was raped by a white man. And the sitting father, feeling the heat of this potential, his dear brother, Vernon Jones, to organize and galvanize the people, because he was an entrepreneur, spoke several languages fluently. The sitting father told the deacons, fire that negro, because he didn't want that kind of negro in the pulpit. And they said, y'all's a boss. Now, if you go by that church today, that's the average Baptist church. If you go by there today, I'm curious, do they have even a plaque near the pulpit where he preached, or his picture where he preached, or anything to reflect that Vernon Johns paved the way that the city fathers thought by getting rid of him that it would kill the movement. And in came a young man from Boston College
The King came from Boston College, and when he came, he brought Ralph Abernathy with him.
Yeah. And so, also, Dr. King, he hanged out with my former pastor, Dr. William Augustus Jones, who helped him formulate Progressive Baptist Convention, because Dr. King was also fed up with the National Baptist Convention, headed forever by a guy named Jackson. This guy Jackson was such a tom. When Dr. King was assassinated, Dr. Jackson, the street that his church is on in Chicago, the street was named after Dr. King. Jackson changed the church's address. That's how much contempt he had for Dr. King, even in death. But to this day, the Northern Baptist Convention has been a bewildering, compromised organization that knows its place with shaking hands with the devil to get that money. And look the other way while our people are being set up for the final solution. Our people don't even realize this may state that we have been set up for the final solution, which is to exterminate us, because they don't want to lead black people. We are with the same position, we're in the same position that Marcus Garvey warned us about, becoming a surplus race of people. We don't listen to our ancestors, so that's one of our biggest downfalls. We got these blacks who know so little about so much. They got a degree, this and a master's in that, but they don't understand that there's one thing being educated, there's another thing being indoctrinated. See, Dr. King, he realized that he had to go the route of being, going against the grain. He even was a member of the Greek organization. But he knew that that was not going to save black people from what we were facing. And he began evolving to the point where the government knew that Dr. King was not for sale, and Hoover realized that they had to take him out. Jesse Jackson and Andy Young knew full well that the setup in Memphis was deliberately derailed to get Dr. King in a position where he would be bumped off. But every time he was in Memphis, it was a black security detail specifically to give him security. That fateful day, the black security was removed, and Dr. King's room was changed, and the rest is history as to how Jesse Jackson. I put my life on this Jesse Jackson. And Andy Young knew that Dr. King was going to be bumped off and not to leave Memphis alive.
And don't forget that pastor, oh my gosh, we used to attend his church right there on South Parkway. Who I can call his name right now.
In Memphis?
Yes, in Memphis. Because there's actually a video of him speaking, and he says, and then I stepped to the side so that they could get a better shot. I can't call his name right now.
Go look him up.
Yeah, what's his name?
Go to the alphabet.
I got a book, man, here with his name. I have a book.
Yeah, it'll come to me.
Earl Cole said he saw the actual sniper walk right by him. Earl was in these bushes, and he stepped back a little so he was fearful for his life. So the white man took the shot, came right past Earl while Earl was hiding in the bushes. When he told the FBI what happened, and those bushes were a way to cover the man as he came out of the bushes, took the shot, and came back. He didn't see Earl, but when Earl told the FBI about these bushes, the following day, the bushes was cut down.
Okay, Reverend Samuel Billy Kyles, that's right.
Kyle?
Samuel Billy Kyles. Mm-hmm.
K-Y-L-E-S?
Yeah, Samuel Billy Kyles. I wish I had time to play this video. I will play it for you.
Wow.
Let me see if I can. I'll try to play this video. But just like Dr. King and just like Malcolm and so many others, I was watching a documentary earlier today on Thomas Sankara, Prime Minister of Sankara, Thomas Sankara of Burkina Faso. Mm-hmm. He was rebelling against the French. Mm-hmm. Telling them to get the hell out of here, and yep. He was instituting programs to help his people. He said that they weren't going to buy any more American clothes. People were going to utilize their own weavers of the area, and I mean, he was doing so much. And of course, who did the French? Well, what happened? The French paid his friend, Sankara's friend. What's his name? Blaise Compaoré or something like that, paid him to lead up a coup going along with the Ivory Coast sellout prime minister at that time. I think Bonnet or something. Bonnet was his name. And overthrew Sankara, somebody that's trying to do something for the people. As usual, they always find some black neck to try
In the Congo, this warrior, brave warrior, not for sale man named Patrice Lumumba. He was in the office 3 months. And his lieutenant that was under his wing, James Lumumba,
His name was Tshombe.
No, I'm talking about the dinosaur named Joseph Mobutu. Mobutu asked the CIA what was in it for him if he was to sell out Lumumba. And they told him one word, lots.
But it was one before Mobutu. It was one before Mobutu. It was Tshombe. Right. Tshombe was the first one. And, you know, but this is something that they didn't tell you. John Kennedy gave the final order to annihilate Lumumba. The order fell from Eisenhower to Kennedy. When Kennedy took over as president, that was in 1961. That's the year they actually killed Patrice Lumumba. And what they did, the order came from the CIA, the same way that they did, that's the same thing they did to Patrice Lumumba. The orders came from the CIA, and Lumumba was captured along with his lieutenant, and, you know, they were taken out into the woods, and they were assassinated. And after their assassination, they burn their bodies and crush their bones. See, when white when the press, I know we got 10 minutes left. I'm gonna be very quick because I wanna give you that date of my videotape with C-SPAN. When they do this, what they're doing the same thing that they did when they killed Nat Turner and put his head on the post and let all the slaves pass all the slaves by and let them see it. But that would put the seed of God in them and said, if you ever try this again, this is what's going to happen to you. So when Idi Amin tried it, what they did, they used the media to destroy Idi Amin in respect to the people and then turn around and they killed him.
Idi Amin was the stooge to the Zionist Israelis. I heard that Israel had a role in propping up Idi Amin. Israel, that's Zionist Israel.
That's what they told you. The main thing about Idi Amin was that every foreign person, most of them were East Indians, most of these people, the Hindus, he kicked all of them out of their business. Okay, he kicked them all out of their businesses that they had, and he pushed them out of the country. He pushed all the Jews out of the country. He wanted all that land for African people. Same thing Mugabe is doing. But, you know, when you take those kind of stances on an international basis, and these people want to destroy the Congo, they want to continue to rape Africa of its resources, then the walls that are created that we see are actually orchestrated by underhanded activities such as they did with Lumumba. You know, after they got tired of the Shambi, they kicked the Shambi out and they put Mobutu in there. Then they filled him with cancer and they killed him and he died in France. So, you know, this is a...
Let me... I finally got this little quick clip up, Brother Brown.
In a hotel, but when
you get your date for us, Brother Brown.
Memphis to Jackson, or Jackson to Memphis, that went a hotel. You stayed in churches, you stayed in people's homes, and that's how we got over. That's how we got through. The struggle was a spiritual struggle. You couldn't pay people to do what we had to do. You couldn't pay people to stand before mad dogs and fire hoses and billy clubs and cattle prods. It was strictly a spiritual and moral movement. So we wanted that dimension to be in the pilgrimage to Memphis. We will revisit the mountaintop speech site. That's the Mason Temple where Dr. King made his last address, which he almost didn't make because the night that we were having that rally, there were tornado warnings, and he was behind on the Poor People's Campaign. And he said, you guys go on over and have the rally. I want to stay at the motel and work on the Poor People's Campaign. When we got there, and Dr. Abernathy walked in, and Jesse Jackson walked in, and I walked in, and others, people started clapping because they thought Martin was behind us. And so Ralph Preacher sent, said to him, this is not our crowd. And he went to the phone and called Dr. King and said, any of the marches that we had in those days, you have an opportunity to bring the children and bring the family and march with us. And when I finished sharing with them the last hour of Dr. King's life, I hurried. But that gave me the wonderful privilege of spending the last hour on earth. Three preachers in a room. The press is always curious and writers, what's wrong? What did you talk about? I said, we're just talking preacher talk. What the preachers talk about when they get together. No, please, by 6:15, we walked on the balcony, and he was talking to people in the courtyard. He stood here, and I stood there. Only as I moved away, so we could have a clear shot, the shot rang out. Thank you. Turned around, and then I stood back on the balcony.
And that was Reverend Billy Kyle. And you heard him say, as he moved away so that they could get a clear shot. Ew.
Well, you know, that's what we get. That's what we have to look at these provocateurs there. And what I would like to do on my next program, I would like to share some time with the listening audience and let them see how, as an ex-Panther, well, I say ex-Panther organization is no longer in place, but how, as I have been castigated, investigated continuously over the years by the federal authorities as well as the city government and police. And I was living in office for my activism. And I would just like to share some of the things that happened to me in relationship to what happened to some of the older members of the Panther Party and how this continuing element is still pervasive today. But let me give you the state of my C-SPAN appearance. This May 6, 1997. If you go to C-SPAN and you type in this date in the archive, it will come up with the program, and you just play it, and then you will see my interview I had about, I think I did an hour on tape. It was maybe 2 hours, but it was a 2-hour session on public housing. And I was asked to go there by the, Public Law Information Bureau out of Richmond. And they asked me to represent from a standpoint of being a pro-activist for public housing. So I went to Washington, D.C., and we went on and I did the program. This is very interesting. Got a lot of viewpoints out. And these are things that I have done over the years that I would like to share with people.
So all right, Brother Brown, got to get the music playing on us. We got to cut it short. Well, we got to cut it off. It is 11:01, and we thank everyone for listening to us. Brother Brown, we'll pick back up with that. So just let me know. We'll put that show up, and you can tune in, and we'll listen to Brother Brown share with us some of his experiences dealing in this system. Thank you so much, Brother Brown, King B, Delta. Thank you, listeners. Thank you, everyone, for listening in. Have a wonderful, prosperous week. Peace and